Business.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody, and I know everyone's getting ready for an exciting long weekend, July 4th. We're going to spend this show focusing on some of the major decisions made by the Supreme Court of the United States over the last 10 days as they wrapped up this term and took the rest of the summer off. We're going to hit some things in the energy area, but we're going to focus a lot of attention on the major healthcare decisions and the major labor decisions made at the Supreme Court today and last week, excuse me. Joining us for our first segment is Michael Lotito. Michael is the co-chair of the Littler Mendelson Workplace Policy Institute and provides advocacy services on all workplace concerns to a variety of clients. He works out of the Littler Mendelson San Francisco office and does a lot of work under the National Labor Relations Act. He's here to talk to us about two major labor cases that were decided by the Supremes last week, National Labor Relations Board versus Noel Canning and Harris versus Quinn. So, Michael, welcome to the show, and let's start with Noel Canning. That might be the more high-visibility case on the labor front the Supreme Court decided last week. Tell us a little bit about that case and why it's so important.
Hi, Kevin. It's a delight to be with you and with your listeners. Noel Canning is really a blockbuster case, especially from a constitutional perspective, that happened to arise in a labor relations setting. Constitutionally, it was the first time the court in its history had an opportunity to deal with interpreting the recess appointment clause in the Constitution. And they held that a recess appointment between 0 and 3 days is simply not long enough, and therefore any appointments made within that short a period of time are invalid. If there's an appointment made between the 4th and the 10th day of a recess, then presumptively it's invalid unless there's a national emergency. And based upon my analysis of the case, they held that if the appointment is made when the Senate has been out for 29 days or longer, those appointments are all right. We're not really sure what they want to do between the 11th and the 28th day. So additional litigation will develop. So those are some of the constitutional principles, as well as finding that the Senate was working during so-called pro forma sessions, which is very important as it relates to the Labor Board, because the three individuals from the Labor Board that were subject to the particular challenge had been appointed by the President during a period when the Senate had been out, quote-unquote, from December into January. And if the pro forma sessions were found not to be working, then you would have a long recess. But the court found that pro forma was working time. And as a result of all of this gobbledygook, it meant that the appointees to the labor board that the president had made were invalid. And this has tremendous implications for the board going forward.
What was interesting to me about the case was, even though it was a unanimous decision, you really had two very separate views on the appointments clause between the majority and a pretty sharp dissent/concurrence from Scalia there. What do you think it means for the NLRB and perhaps for other recess appointments going forward?
Well, I think you're right, the 5-4 split. I mean, you have 9-0 saying these labor board people are finished, but if the dissent had been in the majority, it would have really gutted the recess appointment power that much more. As far as the labor board and specific application, been some controversy about this, but let's talk about what we know. There's 128 cases that had been appealed from board decisions into the courts of appeal. Clearly, the courts of appeal are going to have to deal with those 128 cases. The labor board has been aggressively reaching out to the courts of appeals and to the litigants, in some instances asking for the cases to be returned to them, in other instances asking the litigants to agree to a motion from the board to have the case returned. And we're not exactly sure how the courts of appeals are going to deal with this, because we've seen this movie a little bit before in the new process deal scenarios from about 4 or 5 years ago. And some of the courts of appeals just said the labor board didn't have any power, we're just dismissing the case. Some of the courts of appeals said it's a mulligan, and we'll send it back and you can do a do-over. So I think that there's going to be litigation with the courts of appeals to see how they handle it. And then, of course, there's a whole rash of decisions, about 300 that were published, another 500 that were unpublished, that the labor board has to deal with. And many of these are very significant from a policy perspective.
Well, let's turn to the other case that the Supreme Court decided here in their closing days, and that's Harris versus Quinn. Tell us a little bit about that decision that came out Monday and what it in, its importance is to the labor movement.
I think that the Harris versus Quinn decision, first, it just involves the public sector, and its immediate impact is relatively modest, because the court found that the home health care workers who had brought the suit, represented by National Right to Work, were in a quasi-employment relationship with the state of Illinois. And that gave the court the opportunity to distinguish the way they are employed versus a prior precedent in Abood, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a second. So given this quasi nature of employment, the court found that it was unconstitutional, as against First Amendment principles, to require the members of the bargaining unit, these home health care workers, to pay the equivalent of dues, called an agency fee, to the union in the negotiation of their collective bargaining agreement, because in the public sector, the majority concluded that the negotiations have a real political overtone to them, and it was compelled speech. And as a result, this particular schematic with respect to the employment was found to prevent the union from mandating the payment of dues. So the immediate impact is that there's these kinds of arrangements in about 14 states that either the SEIU or AFSCME have with different state governments. And if there's agency fee provisions in those collective bargaining agreements, they're not going to be enforceable. The broader issue, which the court did not address, is one that was, quote-unquote, decided upon in this Abood case. And there, the public sector employees who were directly employed by the state or the governmental unit were forced to pay agency fees as a condition of employment, and the court in that case held that it was permissible. But there's a lot of language in the majority and in the minority with respect to Harris versus Quinn that puts Abood in play. And many people, including me, believe that if you get a case before the court involving public sector workers who are directly employed by the state, where the collective bargaining is so tied to the political process, for example, in Detroit with respect to the bankruptcies, or Stockton or Vallejo, and you're able to demonstrate that the union takes the fees, gives it to the politicians who then get elected, who then approve the collective bargaining agreement, and then the union used the fees to even thwart the will of the voters when the voters say, as they did in San Jose, let's change the pension formulations, and now they're using those fees in order to contest it from a litigation standpoint. I think the court is going to say this is too much like forced political speech, and that is what I believe is keeping public sector unions awake at night.
Gotcha. Well, let's turn our attention from the decisions made to the decisions to come, because the Supreme Court has started announcing some of the cases it'll look at in the next term, and we know also the NLRB is looking at cases. I know that the NLRB has asked for amicus briefs in two recent cases. Talk to us about what those cases are, what the policy implications are, and what it might mean for us in the workplace.
Well, in the Purple Communication case, where the board is considering whether it's going to reverse the holding of Registered Guard, this has tremendous implications for all employers. And let me be clear. A lot of people say it's the labor board. Those are the union people. No, these rules are applying to the non-union segment of the population, which is about 93% of everybody who works in the private sector today. And the issue at stake in Purple Communications is whether or not the employer is going to be required to permit employees, at least under some circumstances, to use the employer's email system to encourage, solicit, and distribute union information to encourage their fellow non-union employees to get involved with the union. The Registered Guard case that held that this was employer's property and said that that is not permissible, but we're not going to be surprised if this current labor board reverses that. And the other case, the Brown-Ferring case, involves joint employment relationships. There's a lot of discussion and litigation, whether it's from the Department of Labor or on a local level with the Seattle ordinance with $15, where different entities that have always been separate employers are now being considered as a single employer, whether it's two different franchisees under one brand or whether it's in a contracting situation. So the Brown-Ferring case has enormous importance because we think that the labor board is poised to redefine the nature of who is and who is not an employer of employees.
Gotcha. Well, I know the NLRB has also suggested new election rules. Tell us about the highlights of that, and when do you expect those to take effect?
Well, one has to question whether this Noel Canning decision is going to slow down the labor board because they're going to have to look backwards in doing some of these mulligans as opposed to looking forward. But I think this board is absolutely committed to changing the election process. And at a very high level, the new proposed rules are going to reduce the NLRB election period from about 38 to 42 days down to somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 to 20 or so. There's a whole variety of other technical changes, but this is the most dramatic change in the labor board election rules since a statutory change in 1959 permitted the board to delegate their responsibility in these elections to the regional directors. This is a huge, big deal, and when you combine electronic communications and who's an employer and micro-bargaining units and quickie elections, this labor board is living up to its reputation that it's really pro-union.
Gotcha. Well, Michael, why don't you give folks your contact information in case they want more info from you?
Well, thanks. It's M. Lotito at Littler, M-L-O-T-I-T-O at littler.com. And I'd be happy to take any questions that people might have.
Great. We're going to take a quick commercial break, then we're going to come back and talk about the Hobby Lobby case, the major health care decision that came out of the Supreme Court on Monday. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we want to talk about the Hobby Lobby case, and joining us from the Squire Patton Boggs Phoenix office is Lou Clark. Lou concentrates his practice counseling and private and public sector employers in all types of labor and employment matters. And clearly, this Hobby Lobby case is one of the big decisions that impacts employer-employee relationships. So, Lou, welcome to the show, and we're going to get in-depth here on Hobby Lobby. Tell us a little bit about Hobby Lobby and how it came to get to the Supreme Court, and there seems to be a lot of confusion about what the issue was at the end of the day that was before the court.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me on the show today. Glad to be with you. So the Hobby Lobby case is actually two cases that came to the Supreme Court. It involves three businesses. And the two cases for these three businesses came out of the state of Oklahoma and the state of Pennsylvania. And these three businesses are all for-profit, family-owned businesses. Hobby Lobby, which is a pretty commonly known name, is a craft store business that employs about 13,000 workers around the United States, owned by Mr. and Mrs. David Green and their children. And the Green family are all devout Christians, and they operate their business based on Christian and biblical principles. Another business is Mardell, and Mardell is a business owned by the Green's children, and they employ about 300 workers, and they own and operate Christian bookstores. And then there's another business, a Pennsylvania business called Conestoga Wood Specialties, which is a cabinet business owned by a Mennonite family, the Hahns, Mr. and Mrs. Hahn and their three sons. And they're members of the Mennonite Church and employ about 950 employees. Now, all of these businesses and their owners objected to the regulations of the Department of Health and Human Services that required employers covered by the Affordable Care Act to offer coverage for 20 FDA-approved contraceptive methods. Now, the businesses didn't object to all 20 of the contraceptive methods, just four that have the effect of preventing a fertilized egg from attaching to the uterus. And so each of these business owners' religious beliefs included opposing abortion and believing that the four contraceptive methods essentially constituted abortion or participated in abortion. And so the businesses were faced with a dilemma: either provide the coverage contrary to their religious beliefs or refuse to provide the coverage and pay a pretty hefty price in the form of either daily or annual fines. In Hobby Lobby's case, their noncompliance would have cost them about $1.3 million a day, or about $475 million a year. Conestoga would have paid $33 million a year, and Mardell about $15 million a year if they chose to disregard the law's requirements. Now, the alternative for them was to not provide coverage at all, which in their view was just wrong from an employee perspective, and also would frankly make it difficult for them to compete for employees, retain employees, and still would cost them millions of dollars, including for Hobby Lobby. Even that alternative would have cost them $26 million. So what happened was businesses each filed lawsuits against the Department of Health and Human Services to enjoin the enforcement of the contraceptive mandate, and they got mixed results. Now, each of the businesses lost their cases at the trial court level, both in Pennsylvania and Oklahoma, but in the Third Circuit affirmed the Pennsylvania court decision, but the Tenth Circuit reversed the Oklahoma decision. And that, of course, created a conflict between these two circuits, which, along with the substantive issue, that circuit court conflict, of course, was a big reason why the court took this case up.
And so what did they actually decide?
What's that?
What was the actual core holding in this case?
So the issue was, and it's important to keep in mind that the court was very careful to articulate the issue very narrowly. And the issue was whether or not a different federal statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, prohibited the contraception requirement with respect to closely held businesses when those businesses' owners have sincerely held religious beliefs that conflict with that requirement. And so the court decided in favor of the businesses. The court found that the businesses first do have rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that the contraception mandate substantially burdened the exercise of religion and was not the least restrictive means of furthering the government's objective. So essentially the court found that these three businesses are not required to offer a health plan that provides coverage for those contraceptive methods to which they objected on religious grounds. So that was the issue before the court, and that was the boiled down to its essence. That was the court's decision, Kevin.
And so you've got two very separate opinions, majority and minority. Maybe walk us through the rationales underlying both the majority and minority opinion there.
Yeah, sure. And so from the majority's perspective, the first issue that had to be decided was whether or not a for-profit business, a corporation, even has rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And, of course, the dissent contended that the statute, the federal statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, was designed to protect individuals, not corporations. But the majority looked at the word persons, and I'm air quoting the word persons for the listeners, and that word is defined in federal law. And it's interesting that the court looked at the very first section of the very first title of the United States Code, 1 U.S.C. Section 1, which is actually the Dictionary Act, to determine what the word persons means. And the word persons is defined to include corporations. And the majority found that there's no reason why this law, the RFRA, should be construed to exclude corporations from its coverage. Now, the dissent contended, you know, first of all, that that's just chaotic, and also that how can a corporation actually have religious beliefs, and how can you actually ascertain that? It's completely impractical. Now, and the majority concluded that while it may be difficult to ascertain the religious beliefs of a private for-profit business, the fact that it would be difficult to do so should not mean that, by definition, corporations don't have rights under that statute. And I think, frankly, that it is probably difficult, and frankly, many of my clients, it would be difficult to ascertain that they have any religious beliefs at all, but at the same time, there are many businesses that are owned by individuals who do operate in accordance with religious principles, and they're owned by individuals who are devoutly religious. And it is very apparent, Hobby Lobby being a good example of that, because this is a business that is very open and public about its Christian views. So that was the first question, is are they even covered by the law? And then the next issue was whether or not the contraceptive mandate under the ACA actually furthers some compelling government interest. And the court didn't reach that conclusion and basically concluded that, yes, indeed, that it is a compelling government interest, and without having to reach that conclusion, to have access to FDA-approved contraceptives is a compelling interest. But the court went on to conclude or to determine whether or not the government had chosen the least restrictive means to further that objective, basically. And the court concluded, and this is really where the majority and the dissent had the most stinging opposition, was that the majority concluded that they did not choose the least restrictive means for furthering that objective. Now, in support of that conclusion, the majority looked at the fact that the government had already exempted faith-based nonprofit organizations from the contraception requirement, and found, frankly, no reason why that exemption should be limited to nonprofit faith-based organizations. And so by providing that exemption, the majority concluded that the government demonstrated that there was a less restrictive way to further that objective. And also, frankly, the court found that if this was such an important objective in this law, that, frankly, the government could assume the cost of providing for the contraceptive requirement in that was objectionable. And so those were really the issues before the court. And
Lou, I got about 2 minutes left. So what are the key takeaways for employers?
So it's really interesting. Now, of course, the case itself is so newsworthy because of the confluence of so many political and government issues. It's similar to the Noel Canning case that Michael talked about. And, you know, this is the separation of powers hard at work. But from a practical standpoint, a couple of things for businesses. It's important for businesses in particular to keep in mind that this is a narrow decision. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, first of all, only applies to federal laws that purportedly infringe on the exercise of religion. It doesn't apply to state or federal or local law. So in other words, if a business thinks that a state or city ordinance conflicts with their religious beliefs, they shouldn't go around shouting Hobby Lobby and think that they can disregard a state or local law. But also, I think that a lot of businesses who are faith-based, that are for-profit, should not disregard the guidance that I'm sure they've gotten for years, which is not to impose their religious beliefs on the employees. This is not a decision. The Hobby Lobby case is not a case that should empower or embolden individuals to start disregarding that prior guidance. And it's important that the religious discrimination laws are still adhered to by all kinds of businesses, including those run by individuals who are devout in their faith. And then lastly, if any business takes issue with the ACA's requirements based on religious grounds, they should still tread carefully and, of course, get legal counsel before they decide to disregard any of the legal requirements of the ACA or any other federal law, for that matter. Certainly an interesting case, pretty polarizing, and the media has been going crazy about this decision. But those are the practical takeaways for day-to-day business, in my view, Kevin.
Gotcha. Well, Lou, hit everyone with your contact information.
Sure. My email is lew.clark, C-L-A-R-K, at squirepb.com. That's squirepb.com. Happy to answer any other questions folks might have about this case.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more here on Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, it's the last of June, which means the Supreme Court is busy cranking out major decisions that impact us in our everyday lives. And on to talk with us about one of the decisions that's just come out is Doug McWilliams, a partner in the Squire Patton Boggs Cleveland office, where he works on environmental counseling, emphasis on air permitting, enforcement, and administrative procedure. Doug, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking, and maybe tell us about this case that came out from the Supreme Court Monday dealing with the Utility Air Regulatory Group and their battle with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me. Yes, this case dates back to the 2007 Supreme Court case, Massachusetts versus EPA, when the court opened the door to greenhouse gas regulation. But that decision addressed only whether greenhouse gases could fit within the overall scope of the Clean Air Act. Ever since, EPA has been struggling with the specifics over how to regulate greenhouse gases within the major source programs, given that Congress drafted this without having any knowledge that climate change would ultimately be an issue. So the Utility Air Regulatory Group case addresses two Clean Air Act programs that apply to the major stationary sources like utilities and factories. There's an operating permit program under Title V of the Act, and then the Prevention of Significant Deterioration program, which we'll call PSD, that regulates large sources that are newly constructed or modified in a way that significantly increases air emissions. The court reviewed EPA's attempt to solve a dilemma in the statute applied to greenhouse gases. See, Congress established numeric limits, annual numbers of tons per year, that these two programs would use as thresholds to ensure that only the largest sources with sufficient resources to be subject to the burdensome federal permitting programs. However, when these annual thresholds are applied to greenhouse gases, smaller sources became subject to these burdens, certainly more than what Congress had originally intended when they set up these programs. So EPA tried to solve this dilemma by significantly changing the statutory thresholds, by taking a 250-ton per year limit for PSD and changing that to 100,000 tons as it applied to greenhouse gases. This was EPA's tailoring rule. And the Supreme Court in this Utility Air Regulatory Group decision determined that EPA could not make those statutory modifications it believed were necessary and reversed those portions of the case.
So, Doug, I know that EPA has a lot of ongoing permitting programs, a lot of permits already given out or under consideration. How does this Supreme Court ruling have a practical effect on those programs and maybe what's pending or what's already been handed out?
Yeah, there's a significant practical effect for the two permitting programs, although it may be primarily for a narrow band of sources. The court decided that EPA did not have the obligation or discretion to bring new sources into these programs solely on the basis of their greenhouse gas emissions. So the primary beneficiaries from this decision will be sewage treatment plants, certain mining activities, sources combusting biogas or biomass, where their primary emission is greenhouse gases, that they're not emitting conventional pollutants and major source amounts that would subject them to the PSD and Title V permit programs anyway. So many of the changes that EPA has implemented over the past several years for stationary sources will need to be revisited to carve out those sources that the court has determined do not belong and that EPA doesn't have the discretion to include in these major source programs. But the court didn't stop there. You know, the court determined that the court also had to examine whether EPA had the authority to include greenhouse gases in the control technology determinations for these sources that are caught by the Title V and PSD programs anyway. So sources for which conventional pollutants are large enough to expose them to PSD permitting, the court had to determine if EPA had the discretion to require the best available control technology for these greenhouse gases. And in fact, the court determined that the statute did not prohibit EPA from applying back to the best available control technology for greenhouse gases for these sources that are in the programs anyway. So that portion of the tailoring rule that was subject to review remain in place. So EPA will have to go back and pull out those portions of their rule that have been eliminated while retaining those that have been supported by the court's decision.
So what's the broader significance of this ruling?
Well, we talked about a little bit about the significance for that narrow set of sources that are not subject to, that will not be subject to PSD or Title V permits because their sole trigger would be greenhouse gases. But there's some broader themes here. I mean, the court clearly is attacking EPA's exercise of statutory reconstruction, that if EPA is going to address greenhouse gases, they have to do, under the Clean Air Act, they're going to have to do that within the confines of the statute. EPA cannot determine that the greenhouse gases regulation results in absurd results and then read the statute to solve that problem. So certainly the court is telling EPA that they have to do, that they have to stay within the bounds. But EPA is also provided by this decision significant discretion within the confines of the statute, and the backed portion of this decision is a good example of that. What Justice Scalia determined, writing for the majority, is that the agency is not prohibited by statute from applying control technology to greenhouse gases. And while the majority identified a number of restrictions and how that could be applied, the court did stop short of directing EPA as to how BACT would be applied.
So, Doug, I know that from what I've read about the case, there will eventually be other big issues around the Clean Air Act that, pardon the pun, you're going to have to clean up as a result of this case. Can you talk a little more about those?
Sure. One of the significant issues that the court left unresolved is what will be the threshold for these anyway sources in applying the best available control technology to greenhouse gases. The court identified that there's an implicit de minimis threshold below which these back determinations will not be necessary or required, even for sources subject to PSD anyway. That de minimis threshold still needs to be established. EPA in the tailoring rule had set 75,000 tons as an initial significance threshold for greenhouse gases. The court decision does not disturb that, but EPA also made clear that in establishing 75,000 tons, they were not setting a de minimis threshold. They reserved the ability to set a different level for de minimis purposes. So EPA is going to have to go back and work on where they set that threshold for triggering control technology for greenhouse gases.
Very good. And obviously, the Supreme Court took a very middle ground, incremental approach in many regards to this case. Is there anything else about the positioning that they came to this case with that you think impacts the future that people should be thinking about?
Yes, it's been interesting to see the press. All sides in this case are claiming victory, and the court has really set it up so that could happen. The direction to EPA is that they must work within statutory limits. But as Justice Roberts made clear and spent particular time focused on, that EPA had predicted in their rule that 83% of the carbon emissions regulated under their tailoring rule would still be regulated by applying best available control technology to these anyway sources. So the vast majority of the benefits that EPA had hoped to garner from the tailoring rule are still in place by applying best available control technology to major sources triggering PSD anyway. The smaller subset, about 3%, will be eliminated here. And those are sources that are significantly emitting greenhouse gas emissions, but aren't emitting other pollutants. And so EPA will have to, is restricted from using the major source programs of Title V and PSD to regulate those sources under this decision. I think the majority took some comfort in the idea that they could limit EPA's authority, particularly with Justice Scalia writing this opinion, that the statutory limits were necessary, and the court identified and emphasized that EPA must live within those statutory limits. On the other hand, they gave EPA the majority of the authority and discretion to regulate the greenhouse gases that they determined were the primary reason for this tailoring rule.
Doug, hit folks with your email address so they can get more information if they're interested.
Oh, sure. It's douglas.mcwilliams@squirepb.com.
Very good. All right, we're going to turn our attention to the international trade world when we come back after this commercial break here on Capital Thinking.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than five decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome to Capital Thinking. Some things that are impacting college campuses nationwide. We're going to take a look at a Supreme Court ruling this week on the extent of the EPA's power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And we're going to talk about an international trade case and the implications it has in the legal world. We start with college campuses today, and our guests, Susan DeMickley and Amy Davenport from Squire Patton Boggs. Susan is a partner in the Squire Patton Boggs Columbus office, where she's the co-leader of the firm's labor and employment practice. Amy Davenport's public policy specialist in the Washington, D.C. office of Squire Patton Boggs. And they're here to talk about the Department of Education, President Obama, and the United States Congress as they examine Title IX and sexual assault and sexual discrimination on college campuses nationwide. So, Susan, welcome to you and your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. Let's start a little bit with your perspective on what colleges and universities are doing in relation to Title IX, sexual assault, and abuse. We know the Department of Education has been very busy earlier this spring releasing a guidance document with frequently asked questions that schools have about their legal obligations to prevent and respond to sexual assault. So maybe give us the big picture perspective on what's going on and how college campuses are changing their policies as they increase awareness of this issue.
Yeah, well, thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here. And you're right, there's been a lot of talk about this lately. The lawyers are busy, and that's a good thing for you and I, but for colleges and universities, I think this is really a confusing time and a bit frustrating as well. We all agree that the right thing to do is to prevent and to stop sexual assault on campus. And we don't have a lack of guidance out there. At this point, the lawyers are really sorting through a lot of the white papers that place a lot of this squarely in the lap of universities and colleges across America, a societal issue that we do need to address. But in answer to your specific question, what's going on right now, I think that most colleges and universities are dusting off their policies. There are some new guidelines that have been released that you've mentioned. There are also amendments to the Clery Act that went into effect earlier today, and this fall we'll have new reporting requirements. And so there are a host of new requirements that are placed on colleges and universities that now need to kind of go through their policies and make sure they are, in fact, in compliance.
Very good. Well, let's talk a little more about that. Obviously, schools are seeing all these things shift, and they're wondering how to adapt. So what kind of advice are you giving them for how to update their Title IX policies?
Yeah, well, the advice we're giving, first and foremost, is standing still is not an option. You know, we recognize that the guidance is not as clear as we would like. But that being said, waiting until things become clear is not the option that we're advising. What we're advising is take a step back. There are some things that we can do. We can develop a checklist. We can, or you can work with your counsel to develop a toolkit to see, okay, do my policies have some of the basic requirements that we know DOL and OCR and others are saying are best practices. And so there's that piece of it. But then there's also just the training and education piece. You know, summer is a good time when things tend to be a little quieter to think about, you know, ramping up this fall. What are we doing or what aren't we doing that we should be doing in working with our faculty, with our students, with our staff to make sure we've got best practices out there? And so we're having a lot of those discussions this summer as we gear up for, you know, a new season in the fall.
Yeah, so Amy, let me shift to you and talk about what's going on in the halls of Congress. You've got Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri that's sort of been spearheading the sexual assault issue, both in regards to the military and now sexual assault on college campuses. And I know she's got some plans to do some things legislatively on Title IX. She's had a bunch of meetings. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about the meetings that she's had on this topic in Congress and what you think is likely to come out of it related to Title IX?
Absolutely. So over the past month or so, Senator McCaskill and a number of other lawmakers have been hosting roundtables to talk about sexual assault policies on campus, talk about the Clery Act, the Campus Save Act. These are the laws that require colleges and universities to report on sexual assault cases that they're handling on campus. And through these roundtables, Senator McCaskill has said that she's just trying to learn what's going on campus in order to formulate her thoughts and her legislation that she's planning to introduce. We've heard that it's likely that this legislation is going to be introduced after the August recess, so probably September timeframe. And right now, there's actually a bipartisan group of lawmakers that are working on this legislation. Senator McCaskill said she's open to including this in the Higher Education Act reauthorization bill, but since most folks believe that that's unlikely to actually pass this year, they're also talking about moving the bill on its own. They believe that they have the support to do that. But to get into some of the specifics of what the bill might include, Senator McCaskill has said that she is really interested in looking at stronger penalties for colleges that violate the rules on reporting and handling sexual assault cases. And she's also mentioned that she's considering including a requirement in the bill that would impose consistent penalties for students that are found responsible for sexual assault. Right now, there's inconsistent policies across college campuses, but Senator McCaskill is looking at possibly including things like the loss of federal financial aid or having a permanent notation on a student's transcript that would be a consistent policy for all universities to use. She's also interested in looking at increasing the mandatory training requirements for campus staff that are investigating sexual assault crimes, but has also said that she really wants to be careful not to add additional regulations, additional reporting requirements, because a lot of the reporting requirements that colleges and universities already must comply with are burdensome in the eyes of many schools.
interesting. Well, I know one of the things Senator McCaskill has done is send out a survey to about more than 400 institutions asking them for how they deal with these things. And I know there's been some concern at the institutional level that filling out those forms and eventually having that information released publicly, in addition to what's out there on the Clery Act, opens them up some potential liability from the plaintiff's bar in the future. Susan, I want to come back to you and say, related to that, Department of Ed earlier this spring put out a list of 55 colleges and universities that have Title IX violation investigations pending. This is not something they've done before, and while they say it was done in the interest of transparency, it sure looks like it was done as a way to pressure those schools and to raise visibility about this. So talk to me about what it means to be on that list as an institution and how it changes how a university might react to this issue.
Yeah, and look, Kevin, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, there is increased awareness in part because of that list, and while certainly the list was put out there to increase vigilance and to try to draw attention to the issue, I think that what we're seeing is a bit of a chilling effect, and, you know, a list that is requiring those on it to act defensively instead of proactively, and that certainly isn't what we want. You know, we've got to solve this issue together, and it's more than a checklist. But certainly I don't think that that's going to stop. I think we're going to see this list continue. Last I heard, there were about 60 on the list, and I think that, you know, look, the White House just put out its first report on this issue in April, and so they're looking to continue to draw attention and to show that they're doing something about it. And as we see, you know, elections this fall, I think the issue will further ramp up. It's constantly in the press. Not only are the lawyers busy, but we've got students and faculty taking positions on various issues like the standard of evidence that should be used at the local level at internal judiciary proceedings, like the rights of not only the victims but the accused. We've seen men, frankly, continue to bring lawsuits over issues of rights regarding the accused. And so, you know, there are so many complex legal issues that are coming to a head. And, you know, this list, while I think the intentions were perhaps good, what it's doing is it's in part taking away from some of the real issues that we want to get to regarding training and education and putting best practices in place rather than, you know, operating under fear or duress.
So, Amy, let me come back to you on the McCaskill survey because you work with some universities as well. Do you think that their participation in filling out this survey is something they're very wary about and how it could be used against them going forward?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as Susan was mentioning, there's definitely a chilling effect to some extent until colleges and universities can kind of bring their sexual assault policies into current present day. There is some concern about actually, you know, sharing those procedures with senators and with the federal government. But I think one turn of events that was really interesting, the American Council on Education actually held a webinar for its member universities that provided guidance to them on how to respond to Senator McCaskill's survey. And Senator McCaskill was, needless to say, was not happy with this webinar and wrote a pretty strongly worded letter expressing her concern that schools would be less likely to reply as a result of this webinar. Despite the fact that I do think there probably were some schools that may have been a little wary of responding due to the ACES webinar or maybe even just, you know, before the webinar went through, I think that Senator McCaskill probably got enough responses from schools that were willing to participate to really get an understanding of what the current climate is. I think, you know, as we've discussed with the Department of Education's releases the list of schools under investigation for Title IX violations, I think schools are starting to realize that this is a really important issue and that they're going to need to be engaged on it and really thinking about how they're going to be able to comply with Title IX and other laws related to campus safety and sexual assault.
Susan, let me ask you to give folks your email address if they have a desire to get more information from you.
Yeah, absolutely, Kevin. It's Susan, S-U-S-A-N, dot DeMichael, D-I-M-I-C-K-E-L-E, at squirepb.com.
And Amy, the same for you.
Absolutely. It's amy.davenport, D-A-V-E-N-P-O-R-T, at squirepb.com.
All right, Susan DeMichael, Amy Davenport from Squire Patton Boggs, talking about the Title IX debate in the halls of Congress and on college campuses today. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back in just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit about a decision out of the Supreme Court that impacts greenhouse gas emission rules here in the United States.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.